Now let's turn to our inner selves. Have you ever fantasized about killing someone you don't like? In separate studies, the psychologists Douglas Kenrick and David Buss have posed this question to a demographic that is known to have exceptionally low rates of violence, university students, and were stunned at the outcome. Between 70% and 90% of the men and between 50% and 80% of the women admitted to having at least one homicidal fantasy in the preceding year. When I described these studies in a lecture, a student shouted, "Yeah, and the others are lying." At the very least, they may sympathize with Clarence Darrow when he said, "I have never killed a man, but I have read many obituaries with great pleasure." The motives for imaginary homicides overlap with those on police blotters: a lover's quarrel, a response to a threat, vengeance for an act of humiliation or betrayal, and family conflict, proportionally more often with step-parents than with biological parents. Often the reveries are played out before the mind's eye in theatrical detail, like the jealous revenge fantasy entertained by Rex Harrison while conducting a symphony orchestra in Unfaithfully Yours. One young man in Buss's survey estimated that he came 80% of the way toward killing a former friend, who had lied to the man's fiancée that he had been unfaithful to her, and then made a move on the fiancée himself. "First, I would break every bone in his body, starting with his fingers and toes, slowly making my way to larger ones. Then I would puncture his lungs and maybe a few other organs. Basically, give him as much pain as possible before killing him." A woman said she had gone 60% of the way toward killing an ex-boyfriend who wanted to get back together and had threatened to send a video of the two of them having sex to her new boyfriend and her fellow students. "I actually did this. I invited him over for dinner. And as he was in the kitchen looking stupid, peeling carrots to make a salad, I came to him laughing gently so he wouldn't suspect anything. I thought about grabbing a knife quickly and stabbing him in the chest repeatedly until he was dead. I actually did the first thing, but he saw my intentions and ran away." Many actual homicides are preceded by lengthy ruminations just like this. The small number of premeditated murders that are actually carried out must be the cusp of a colossal iceberg of homicidal desires submerged in a sea of inhibitions. As the forensic psychiatrist Robert Simon put it in a book titled, paraphrasing Freud, paraphrasing Plato, "Bad men do what good men dream." Even people who don't daydream about killing get intense pleasure from vicarious experiences of doing it or seeing it done. People spend large amounts of their time and income immersing themselves in any of a number of genre of bloody virtual reality: Bible stories, Homeric sagas, martyrologies, portrayals of hell, hero myths, Gilgamesh, Greek tragedies, Beowulf, the Bayeux tapestry, Shakespearean dramas, Grimm's fairy tales, Punch and Judy, opera, murder mysteries, penny dreadfuls, pulp fiction, dime novels, grand guignol, murder ballads, film noir, westerns, horror comics, superhero comics, The Three Stooges, Tom and Jerry, The Roadrunner, video games, and movies starring a certain ex-governor of California. In Savage Pastimes, A Cultural History of Violent Entertainment, the literary scholar Harold Schechter shows that today's splatter films are mild stuff compared to the simulated torture and mutilation that have titillated audiences for centuries. Long before computer-generated imagery, theater directors would apply their ingenuity to grisly special effects such as phony heads that could be decapitated from dummies and impaled on pikes, fake skin that could be flayed from an actor's torso, concealed bladders filled with animal blood that could produce a satisfying spurt of gore when punctured. The vast mismatch between the number of violent acts that runs through people's imaginations and the number they carry out in the world tells us something about the design of the mind. Statistics on violence underestimate the importance of violence in the human condition. The human brain runs on the Latin adage, "If you want peace, prepare for war." Even in peaceable societies, people are fascinated by the logic of bluff and threat, the psychology of alliance and betrayal, the vulnerabilities of a human body, and how they can be exploited or shielded. The universal pleasure that people take in violent entertainment, always in the teeth of censorship and moralistic denunciation, suggests that the mind craves information on the conduct of violence. A likely explanation is that, in evolutionary history, violence was not so improbable that people could afford not to understand how it works. The anthropologist Donald Simons has noticed a similar mismatch in the other major content of naughty reverie and entertainment: sex. People fantasize about and make art out of illicit sex vastly more often than they engage in it. Like adultery, violence may be improbable, but when an opportunity arises, the potential consequences for Darwinian fitness are gargantuan. Simons suggests that higher consciousness itself is designed for low-frequency, high-impact events. We seldom muse about daily necessities like grasping, walking, or speaking, let alone pay money to see them dramatized. What grabs our mental spotlight is illicit sex, violent death, and Walter Mitty-ish leaps of status. Now, to our brains. The human brain is a swollen and dwarfed version of the brains of other mammals. All the major parts may be found in our furry cousins, where they do pretty much the same things, such as process information from the senses, control muscles and glands, and store and retrieve memories. Among these parts is a network of regions that has been called the rage circuit. The neuroscientist Jacques Panksepp describes what happens when he sent an electrical magnetic current through a part of the rage circuit of a cat. Within the first few seconds of the electrical brain stimulation, the peaceful animal was emotionally transformed. It leaped viciously toward me with claws unsheathed, fangs bared, hissing and spitting. It could have pounced in many different directions, but its arousal was directed right at my head. Fortunately, a plexiglass wall separated me from the enraged beast. Within a fraction of a minute after terminating the stimulation, the cat was again relaxed and peaceful and could be petted without further retribution. The rage circuit in the cat brain has a counterpart in the human brain, and it too can be stimulated by an electrical current. Not in an experiment, of course, but during neurosurgery. A surgeon describes what follows. The most significant and the most dramatic effect of stimulation has been the eliciting of a range of aggressive responses from coherent, appropriately directed verbal responses, speaking to surgeon, "I feel I could get up and bite you," to uncontrolled swearing and physically destructive behavior. On one occasion, the patient was asked, 30 seconds after cessation of the stimulus, if he had felt angry. He agreed that he had been angry, but that he no longer was, and he sounded very surprised. Cats hiss, humans swear. The fact that the rage circuit can activate speech suggests that it is not an inert vestige, but has functioning connections with the rest of the human brain. The rage circuit is one of several circuits that control aggression in non-human mammals, and as we shall see, they help make sense of the varieties of aggression in humans as well. If violence is stamped into our childhoods, our fantasy lives, our art, and our brains, then how is it possible that soldiers are reluctant to fire their guns in combat, when that is what they are there to do? A famous study of World War II veterans claimed that no more than 15 to 25% of them were able to discharge their weapons in battle. Other studies have found that most of the bullets that are fired miss their targets. Now, the first claim is based on a dubious study, and the second is a red herring. Most shots are fired in war not to pick off individual soldiers, but to deter any of them from advancing. Nor is it surprising that when a soldier targets an enemy in combat conditions, it isn't easy to score a direct hit. But let's grant that anxiety on the battlefield is high, and that many soldiers are paralyzed when the time comes to pull the trigger. A nervousness about the use of deadly force may also be seen in street fights and barroom brawls. Most confrontations between macho ruffians are nothing like the stupendous fistfights in Hollywood westerns that so impressed Nabokov's Humbert, with the sweet crash of fist against chin, the kick in the belly, the flying tackle. The sociologist Randall Collins has scrutinized photographs, videotapes, and eyewitness accounts of real fights, and found that they are closer to a 2-minute penalty for roughing in a boring hockey game then an action-packed brawl in Roaring Gulch. Two men glower, talk trash, swing and miss, clutch each other, sometimes fall to the ground. Occasionally, a fist will emerge from the mutual embrace and land a couple of blows, but more often the men will separate, trade angry bluster and face-saving verbiage, and walk away with their egos more bruised than their bodies. It's true, then, that when men confront each other in face-to-face conflict, they often exercise restraint. But this reticence is not a sign that humans are gentle and compassionate. On the contrary, it's just what one would expect from the analyses of violence by Hobbes and Darwin. Recall from Chapter 2 that any tendency toward violence must have evolved in a world in which everyone else was evolving the same tendency. As Richard Dawkins put it, a living thing differs from a rock or a river because it is inclined to hit back. That means that the first move toward harming a fellow human simultaneously accomplishes two things. One, it increases the chance that the target will come to harm. Two, it gives the target an overriding goal of harming you before you harm him. Even if you prevail by killing him, you will have given his kin the goal of killing you in revenge. It stands to reason that initiating serious aggression in a symmetrical standoff is something a Darwinian creature must consider very, very carefully. A reticence experienced as anxiety or paralysis. Discretion is the better part of valor. Compassion has nothing to do with it. When an opportunity does arise to eliminate a hated opponent with little danger of reprisal, a Darwinian creature will seize on it. We saw this in chimpanzee raiding. When a group of males patrolling a territory encounters a male from another community who has been isolated from his fellows, they will take advantage of the strength in numbers and tear him limb from limb. Pre-state peoples, too, decimate their enemies, not in pitched battles, but in stealthy ambushes and raids. Much of human violence is cowardly violence, sucker punches, unfair fights, preemptive strikes, pre-dawn raids, mafia hits, drive-by shootings. Collins also documents a recurring syndrome that he calls forward panic, though a more familiar term would be rampage. When an aggressive coalition has stalked or faced off against an opponent in a prolonged state of apprehension and fear, then catches the opponent in a moment of vulnerability, fear turns to rage, and the men will explode in a savage frenzy. A seemingly unstoppable fury drives them to beat the enemy senseless, torture and mutilate the men, rape the women, and destroy their property. A forward panic is violence at its ugliest. It is the state of mind that causes genocides, massacres, deadly ethnic riots, and battles in which no prisoners are taken. It also lies behind episodes of police brutality, such as the savage beating of Rodney King in 1991, after he had been apprehended in a high-speed car chase and had violently resisted his arrest. As the butchery gains momentum, rage may give way to ecstasy, and the rampagers may laugh and whoop in a carnival of barbarity. No one has to be trained to carry out a rampage, and when they erupt in armies or police squads, the commanders are often taken by surprise and have to take steps to quell them, since the overkill and atrocities serve no military or law enforcement purpose. A rampage may be a primitive adaptation to seize a fleeting opportunity, to decisively rout a dangerous enemy before it can remobilize and retaliate. The resemblance to lethal raiding among chimpanzees is uncanny, including the common trigger, an isolated member of the enemy who is outnumbered by a cluster of three or four allies. The instinct behind rampages suggests that the human behavioral repertoire includes scripts for violence that lie quiescent and may be cued by propitious circumstances rather than building up over time, like hunger or thirst. The moralization gap and the myth of pure evil. In The Blank Slate, I argued that the modern denial of the dark side of human nature, the doctrine of the noble savage, was a reaction against the romantic militarism, hydraulic theories of aggression, and glorification of struggle and strife that had been popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Scientists and scholars who question the modern doctrine have been accused of justifying violence and have been subjected to vilification, blood libel, and physical assault. The noble savage myth appears to be another instance of an anti-violence movement leaving a cultural legacy of propriety and taboo. But I am now convinced that a denial of the human capacity for evil runs even deeper, and may itself be a feature of human nature, thanks to a brilliant analysis by the social psychologist Roy Baumeister in his book, Evil. Baumeister was moved to study the common sense understanding of evil when he noticed that the people who perpetrate destructive acts, from everyday peccadilloes to serial murders and genocides, never think they are doing anything wrong. How can there be so much evil in the world with so few evil people doing it? When psychologists are confronted with a timeless mystery, they run an experiment. Baumeister and his collaborators, Arlene Stilwell and Sarah Wattman, couldn't very well get people to commit atrocities in the lab, but they reasoned that everyday life has its share of smaller hurts that they could put under the microscope. They asked people to describe one incident in which someone angered them, and one incident in which they angered someone. The order of the two questions was randomly flipped from one participant to the next, and they were separated by a busy work task so the participants wouldn't answer them in quick succession. Most people get angry at least once a week, and nearly everyone gets angry at least once a month, so there was no shortage of material. Both perpetrators and victims recounted plenty of lies, broken promises, violated rules and obligations, betrayed secrets, unfair acts, and conflicts over money. But that was all that the perpetrators and victims agreed on. The psychologists pored over the narratives and coded features, such as the time span of the events, the culpability of each side, the perpetrator's motive, and the aftermath of the harm. If one were to weave composite narratives out of their tallies, they might look something like this. The perpetrator's narrative. The story begins with the harmful act. At the time, I had good reasons for doing it. Perhaps I was responding to an immediate provocation, or I was just reacting to the situation in a way that any reasonable person would. I had a perfect right to do what I did, and it's unfair to blame me for it. The harm was minor and easily repaired, and I apologized. It's time to get over it. Put it behind us. Let bygones be bygones. The victim's narrative. The story begins long before the harmful act, which was just the latest incident of a long history of mistreatment. The perpetrator's actions were incoherent, senseless, incomprehensible. Either that, or he was an abnormal sadist, motivated only by a desire to see me suffer, though I was completely innocent. The harm he did is grievous and irreparable, with effects that will last forever. None of us should ever forget it. They can't both be right. Or more to the point, neither of them can be right all of the time, since the same participants provided a story in which they were the victim and a story in which they were the perpetrator. Something in human psychology distorts our interpretation and memory of harmful events. This raises an obvious question. Does our inner perpetrator whitewash our crimes in a campaign to exonerate ourselves? Or does our inner victim nurse our grievances in a campaign to claim the world's sympathy? Since the psychologists were not flies on the wall at the time of the actual incidents, they had no way of knowing whose retrospective accounts should be trusted. In an ingenious follow-up, Stilwell and Baumeister controlled the event by writing an ambiguous story in which one college roommate offers to help another with some coursework, but reneges for a number of reasons, which leads the student to receive a low grade for the course, change his or her major, and switch to another university. The participants, students themselves, simply had to read the story and then retell it as accurately as possible in the first person, half of them taking the perspective of the perpetrator and half the perspective of the victim. A third group was asked to retell the story in the third person. The details they provided or omitted serve as a baseline for ordinary distortions of human memory that are unaffected by self-serving biases. The psychologists coded the narratives for missing or embellished details that would make either the perpetrator or the victim look better. The answer to the question, who should we believe, turned out to be neither. Compared to the benchmark of the story itself, and to the recall of the disinterested third-person narrators, both victims and perpetrators distorted the stories to the same extent, but in opposite directions, each omitting or embellishing details in a way that made the actions of their character look more reasonable and the others less reasonable. Remarkably, nothing was at stake in the exercise. Not only had the participants not taken part in the events, but they were not asked to sympathize with the character or to justify anyone's behavior, just to read and remember the story from a first-person perspective. That was all it took to recruit their cognitive processes to the cause of self-serving propaganda. The diverging narratives of a harmful event in the eyes of the aggressor, the victim, and a neutral party are a psychological overlay on the violence triangle mentioned earlier. Let's call it the moralization gap. The moralization gap is part of a larger phenomenon called self-serving biases. People try to look good. Good can mean effective, potent, desirable, and competent, or it can mean virtuous, honest, generous, and altruistic. The drive to present the self in a positive light was one of the major findings of 20th century social psychology. An early exposé was the sociologist Irving Goffman's The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, and recent summaries include Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson's Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, Robert Trivers's Deceit and Self-Deception, and Robert Kurzban's Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite. Among the signature phenomena are cognitive dissonance, in which people change their evaluation of something they have been manipulated into doing to preserve the impression that they are in control of their actions, and the Lake Wobegon effect, named after Garrison Keillor's fictitious town in which all the children are above average, in which a majority of people rate themselves above average in every desirable talent or trait. Self-serving biases are part of the evolutionary price we pay for being social animals. People congregate in groups not because they are robots who are magnetically attracted to one another, but because they have social and moral emotions. They feel warmth and sympathy, gratitude and trust, loneliness and guilt, jealousy and anger. The emotions are internal regulators that ensure that people reap the benefits of social life, reciprocal exchange and cooperative action, without suffering the costs, namely exploitation by cheaters and social parasites. We sympathize with, trust, and feel grateful to those who are likely to cooperate with us, rewarding them with our own cooperation. And we get angry at or ostracize those who are likely to cheat, withdrawing cooperation or meting out punishment. A person's own level of virtue is a trade-off between the esteem that comes from cultivating a reputation as a cooperator and the ill-gotten gains of stealthy cheating. A social group is a marketplace of cooperators of differing degrees of generosity and trustworthiness, and people advertise themselves as being as generous and trustworthy as they can get away with, which may be a bit more generous and trustworthy than they are. The moralization gap consists of complementary bargaining tactics in the negotiation for recompense between a victim and a perpetrator. Like opposing counsel in a lawsuit over a tort, the social plaintiff will emphasize the deliberateness or at least the depraved indifference of the defendant's action, together with the pain and suffering the plaintiff endures. The social defendant will emphasize the reasonableness or unavoidability of the action and will minimize the plaintiff's pain and suffering. The competing framings shape the negotiations over amends and also play to the gallery in a competition for their sympathy and for a reputation as a responsible reciprocator. Trivers, the first to propose that the moral emotions are adaptations to cooperation, also identified an important twist. The problem with trying to convey an exaggerated impression of kindness and skill is that other people are bound to develop the ability to see through it, setting in motion a psychological arms race between better liars and better lie detection. Lies can be spotted through internal contradictions, as in the Yiddish proverb, a liar must have a good memory, or through tells such as hesitations, twitches, blushes, and sweats. Trivers ventured that natural selection may have favored a degree of self-deception so as to suppress the tells at the source. We lie to ourselves so that we're more believable when we lie to others. At the same time, an unconscious part of the mind registers the truth about our abilities so that we don't get too far out of touch with reality. Trivers credits George Orwell with an earlier formulation of the idea. The secret of rulership is to combine a belief in one's own infallibility with a power to learn from past mistakes. Self-deception is an exotic theory because it makes the paradoxical claim that something called the self can be both deceiver and deceived. It's easy enough to show that people are liable to self-serving biases, like a butcher's scale that has been miscalibrated in the butcher's favor. But it's not so easy to show that people are liable to self-deception, the psychological equivalent of the dual books kept by shady businesses, in which a public ledger is made available to prying eyes and a private ledger with the correct information is used to run the business. A pair of social psychologists, Pier Carlo Valdesolo and David Desteno, have devised an ingenious experiment that catches people in the act of true dual-book self-deception. They asked the participants to cooperate with them in planning and evaluating a study in which half of them would get a pleasant and easy task, namely looking through photographs for 10 minutes, and half would get a tedious and difficult one, namely solving math problems for 45 minutes. They told the participants that they were being run in pairs, but that the experimenters had not yet settled on the best way to decide who got which task. So they allowed each participant to choose one of two methods to decide who would get the pleasant task and who would get the unpleasant one. The participants could just choose the easy task for themselves, or they could use a random number generator to decide who got which. Human selfishness being what it is, almost everyone kept the pleasant task for themselves. Later they were given an anonymous questionnaire to evaluate the experiment, which unobtrusively slipped in a question about whether the participants thought that their decision had been fair. Human hypocrisy being what it is, most of them said it was. Then the experimenters described the selfish choice to another group of participants and asked them how fairly the selfish subject acted. Not surprisingly, they didn't think it was fair at all. The difference between the way people judge other people's behavior and the way they judge their own behavior is a classic instance of a self-serving bias. But now comes the key question. Did the self-servers really, deep down, believe that they were acting fairly? Or did the conscious spin doctor in their brains just say that, while the unconscious reality checker registered the truth? To find out, the psychologists tied up the conscious mind by forcing a group of participants to keep 7 digits in memory while they evaluated the experiment, including the judgment about whether they or others had acted fairly. With the conscious mind distracted, the terrible truth came out. The participants judged themselves as harshly as they judged other people. This vindicates Trivers's theory that the truth was in there all along. I was happy to discover the result, not just because the theory of self-deception is so elegant that it deserves to be true, but because it offers a glimmer of hope for humanity. Though acknowledging a compromising truth about ourselves is among our most painful experiences, Freud posited an armamentarium of defense mechanisms to postpone that dreadful day, such as denial, repression, projection, and reaction formation, it is, at least in principle, possible. It may take ridicule. It may take argument. It may take time. It may take being distracted. But people have the means to recognize that they are not always in the right. Still, we shouldn't deceive ourselves about self-deception. In the absence of these puncturings, the overwhelming tendency is for people to misjudge the harmful acts they have perpetrated or experienced. Once you become aware of this fateful quirk in our psychology, social life begins to look different, and so do history and current events. It's not just that there are two sides to every dispute, it's that each side sincerely believes its version of the story, namely that it is an innocent and long-suffering victim, and the other side a malevolent and treacherous sadist. And each side has assembled a historical narrative and database of facts consistent with its sincere belief. For example, the Crusades were an upwelling of religious idealism that were marked by a few excesses, but left the world with the fruits of cultural exchange. The Crusades were a series of vicious pogroms against Jewish communities that were part of a long history of European antisemitism. The Crusades were a brutal invasion of Muslim lands and the start of a long history of humiliation of Islam by Christendom. The American Civil War was necessary to abolish the evil institution of slavery and preserve a nation conceived in liberty and equality. The American Civil War was a power grab by a centralized tyranny intended to destroy the way of life of the traditional South. The Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe was the act of an evil empire drawing an iron curtain across the continent. The Warsaw Pact was a defensive alliance to protect the Soviet Union and its allies from a repeat of the horrendous losses it had suffered from two German invasions. The Six-Day War was a struggle for national survival. It began when Egypt expelled UN peacekeepers and blockaded the Straits of Tiran, the first step in its plan to push the Jews into the sea, and it extended when Israel reunified a divided city and secured defensible borders. The Six-Day War was a campaign of aggression and conquest. It began when Israel invaded its neighbors and ended when it expropriated their land and instituted an apartheid regime. Adversaries are divided not just by their competitive spin doctoring, but by the calendars with which they measure history and the importance they put on remembrance. The victims of a conflict are assiduous historians and cultivators of memory. The perpetrators are pragmatists, firmly planted in the present. Ordinarily, we tend to think of historical memory as a good thing. But when the events being remembered are lingering wounds that call for redress, it can be a call to violence. The slogans, "Remember the Alamo," "Remember the Maine," "Remember the Lusitania," "Remember Pearl Harbor," and "Remember 9/11," were not advisories to brush up your history, but battle cries that led to Americans engaging in wars. It is often said that the Balkans are a region that is cursed with too much history per square mile. The Serbs, who in the 1990s perpetrated ethnic cleansings in Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo, are also among the world's most aggrieved people. They were inflamed by memories of depredations by the Nazi puppet state in Croatia in World War II, the Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War I, and the Ottoman Turks going back to the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. On the 600th anniversary of that battle, President Slobodan Milosevic delivered a bellicose speech that presaged the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. In the late 1970s, the newly elected separatist government of Quebec rediscovered the thrills of 19th-century nationalism, and among other trappings of Quebecois patriotism, replaced the license plate motto, "La Belle Provence," the beautiful province, with "Je me souviens," I remember. It was never made clear exactly what was being remembered, but most people interpreted it as nostalgia for New France, which had been vanquished by Britain during the Seven Years' War in 1763. All this remembering made Anglophone Quebecers a bit nervous and set off an exodus of my generation to Toronto. Fortunately, late 20th century European pacifism prevailed over 19th century Gallic nationalism, and Quebec today is an unusually cosmopolitan and peaceable part of the world. The counterpart of too much memory on the part of victims is too little memory on the part of perpetrators. On a visit to Japan in 1992, I bought a tourist guide that included a helpful timeline of Japanese history. There was an entry for the period of the Taisho democracy from 1912 to 1926, and then there was an entry for the Osaka World's Fair in 1970. I guess nothing interesting happened in Japan in the years in between. It's disconcerting to realize that all sides to a conflict, from roommates squabbling over a term paper to nations waging world wars, are convinced of their rectitude and can back up their convictions with a historical record. That record may include some whoppers, but it may just be biased by the omission of facts we consider significant and the sacralization of facts we consider ancient history. The realization is disconcerting because it suggests that in a given disagreement, the other guy might have a point. we may not be as pure as we think. The two sides will come to blows, each convinced that it is in the right, and no one will think the better of it because everyone's self-deception is invisible to them. For example, few Americans today would second-guess the participation of the Greatest Generation in the epitome of a just war, World War II. Yet it's unsettling to reread Franklin Roosevelt's historic speech following Japan's 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor and see that it is a textbook case of a victim narrative. All the coding categories of the Baumeister experiment can be filled in. The fetishization of memory. A date which will live in infamy. The innocence of the victim. The United States was at peace with that nation. The senselessness and malice of the aggression. This unprovoked and dastardly attack. The magnitude of the harm. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. Very many American lives have been lost, and the justness of retaliation. The American people and their righteous might will win. Historians today point out that each of these ringing assertions was, at best, truthy. The United States had imposed a hostile embargo of oil and machinery on Japan, had anticipated possible attacks, had sustained relatively minor military damage, eventually sacrificed 100,000 American lives in response to the 2,500 lost in the attack, forced innocent Japanese Americans into concentration camps, and attained victory with incendiary and nuclear strikes on Japanese civilians that could be considered among history's greatest war crimes. Even in matters when no reasonable third party can doubt who's right and who's wrong, we have to be prepared, when putting on psychological spectacles, to see that evildoers always think they are acting morally. The spectacles are a painful fit. Just monitor your blood pressure as you read the sentence, "Try to see it from Hitler's point of view," or Osama bin Laden's, or Kim Jong-il's. Yet Hitler, like all sentient beings, had a point of view, and historians tell us that it was a highly moralistic one. He experienced Germany's sudden and unexpected defeat in World War I and concluded that it could be explained only by the treachery of an internal enemy. He was aggrieved by the Allies' murderous post-war food blockade and their vindictive reparations. He lived through the economic chaos and street violence of the 1920s. And Hitler was an idealist. He had a moral vision in which heroic sacrifices would bring about a thousand-year utopia. At the smaller scale of interpersonal violence, the most brutal serial killers minimize and even justify their crimes in ways that would be comical if their actions were not so horrific. In 1994, the police quoted a spree killer as saying, "Other than the two we killed, the two we wounded, the woman we pistol-whipped, and the light bulbs we stuck in people's mouths, we didn't really hurt anybody." A serial rapist murderer interviewed by the sociologist Diana Scully claimed to be kind and gentle to the women he captured at gunpoint, and that they enjoyed the experience of being raped. As further proof of his kindness, he noted that when he stabbed his victims, the killing was always sudden, so they wouldn't know it was coming. John Wayne Gacy, who kidnapped, raped, and murdered 33 boys, said, "I see myself more as a victim than as a perpetrator," adding, without irony, "I was cheated out of my childhood." His victimization continued into adulthood, when the media inexplicably tried to make him into an asshole and a scapegoat. Smaller-time criminals rationalize just as readily. Anyone who has worked with prisoners know that today's penitentiaries are filled to a man with innocent victims. Not just those who were framed by sloppy police work, but those whose violence was a form of self-help justice. Remember Donald Black's theory of crime as social control, Chapter 3, which seeks to explain why a majority of violent crimes don't bring the perpetrator a tangible benefit? The offender is genuinely provoked by an affront or betrayal. The reprisal that we deem to be excessive, striking a sharp-tongued wife during an argument, killing a swaggering stranger over a parking spot, is, from his point of view, a natural response to a provocation and the administration of rough justice. The unease with which we read these rationalizations tells us something about the very act of donning psychological spectacles. Baumeister notes that in the attempt to understand harm-doing, the viewpoint of the scientist or scholar overlaps with the viewpoint of the perpetrator. Both take a detached, amoral stance toward the harmful act. Both are contextualizers, always attentive to the complexities of the situation and how they contributed to the causation of the harm. And both believe that the harm is ultimately explicable. The viewpoint of the moralist, in contrast, is the viewpoint of the victim. The harm is treated with reverence and awe. It continues to evoke sadness and anger long after it was perpetrated. And for all the feeble ratiocination we mortals throw at it, it remains a cosmic mystery, a manifestation of the irreducible and inexplicable existence of evil in the universe. Many chroniclers of the Holocaust consider it immoral even to try to explain it. Baumeister, with psychological spectacles still affixed, calls this the myth of pure evil. The mindset that we adopt when we don moral spectacles is the mindset of the victim. Evil is the intentional and gratuitous infliction of harm for its own sake, perpetrated by a villain who is malevolent to the bone, inflicted on a victim who is innocent and good. The reason that this is a myth when seen through psychological spectacles is that evil in fact is perpetrated by people who are mostly ordinary and who respond to their circumstances, including provocations by the victim, in ways they feel are reasonable and just. The myth of pure evil gives rise to an archetype that is common in religions, horror movies, children's literature, nationalist mythologies, and sensationalist news coverage. In many religions, evil is personified as the devil. Hades, Satan, Beelzebub, Lucifer, Mephistopheles, or as the antithesis to a benevolent god in a bilateral Manichaean struggle. In popular fiction, evil takes the form of the slasher, the serial killer, the boogeyman, the ogre, the Joker, the James Bond villain, or, depending on the cinematic decade, the Nazi officer, Soviet spy, Italian gangster, Arab terrorist, inner-city predator, Mexican drug lord, galactic emperor, or corporate executive. The evildoer may enjoy money and power, but these motives are vague and ill-formed. What he really craves is the infliction of chaos and suffering on innocent victims. The evildoer is an adversary, the enemy of good, and the evildoer is often foreign. Hollywood villains, even if they are stateless, speak with a generic foreign accent. The myth of pure evil bedevils our attempt to understand real evil, because the standpoint of the scientist resembles the standpoint of the perpetrator, while the standpoint of the moralizer resembles the standpoint of the victim. The scientist is bound to be seen as making excuses or blaming the victim, or as trying to vindicate the amoral doctrine that to understand all is to forgive all. Recall Lewis Richardson's reply that to condemn much is to understand little. The accusation of relativizing evil is particularly likely when the motive the analyst imputes to the perpetrator appears to be venal, like jealousy, status, or retaliation, rather than grandiose, like the persistence of suffering in the world or the perpetuation of race, class, or gender oppression. It is also likely when the analyst describes the motive to every human being, rather than to a few psychopaths or to the agents of a malignant political system, hence the popularity of the doctrine of the noble savage. The scholar Hannah Arendt, in her writings on the trial of Adolf Eichmann for his role in organizing the logistics of the Holocaust, coined the expression, "the banality of evil," to capture what she saw as the ordinariness of the man and the ordinariness of his motives. Whether or not she was right about Eichmann, and historians have shown that he was more of an ideological anti-Semite than Arendt allowed, she was prescient in deconstructing the myth of pure evil. As we shall see, 4 decades of research in social psychology, some of it inspired by Arendt herself, have underscored the banality of most of the motives that lead to harmful consequences. In the rest of this chapter, I'll lay out the brain systems and motives that incline us toward violence while trying to identify the inputs that ramp them up or down, and thereby offer insight into the historical decline of violence. Appearing to take the perspective of the perpetrator is just one of the dangers that attends this effort. Another is the assumption that nature organized the brain into systems that are morally meaningful to us, such as ones that lead to evil and ones that lead to good. As we shall see, some of the dividing lines between the inner demons of this chapter and the better angels of the next were guided as much by expository convenience as by neurobiological reality, because certain brain systems can cause both the best and the worst in human behavior. Organs of violence. One of the symptoms of the myth of pure evil is to identify violence as an animalistic impulse, as we see in words like beastly, bestial, brutish, inhuman, and wild, and in depictions of the devil with horns and a tail. But while violence is certainly common in the animal kingdom, to think of it as arising from a single impulse is to see the world through a victim's eyes. Consider all the destructive things that members of our species do to ants. We eat them, poison them, accidentally trample them, and deliberately squish them. Each category of formicide is driven by an utterly distinct motive. But if you were an ant, you might not care about these fine distinctions. We are humans, so we tend to think that the terrible things that humans do to other humans come from a single animalistic motive. But biologists have long noted that the mammalian brain has distinct circuits that underlie very different kinds of aggression. The most obvious form of aggression in the animal kingdom is predation. Hunters such as hawks, eagles, wolves, lions, tigers, and bears adorn the jerseys of athletes and the coats of arms of nations, and many writers have blamed human violence, as William James did, on the carnivore within. Yet biologically speaking, predation for food could not be more different from aggression against rivals and threats. Cat people are well aware of the distinction. When their animal companion sets its sights on a beetle on the floorboards, it is crouched, silent, and intently focused. But when one alley cat faces off against another, the cat stands tall, fur erect, hissing and yowling. We saw how neuroscientists can implant an electrode into the rage circuit of a cat, press a button, and set the animal on attack mode. With the electrode implanted in a different circuit, they can set it on hunting mode and watch in amazement as the cat quietly stalks a hallucinatory mouse. Like many systems in the brain, the circuits that control aggression are organized in a hierarchy. Subroutines that control the muscles and basic actions are encapsulated in the hind brain, which sits on top of the spinal cord. But the emotional states that trigger them, such as the rage circuit, are distributed higher up in the midbrain and forebrain. In cats, for example, stimulating the hind brain can activate what neuroscientists call sham rage. The cat hisses, bristles, and extends its fangs, but it can be petted without it attacking the petter. If, in contrast, they stimulate the rage circuit higher up, the resulting emotional state is no sham. The cat is mad as hell and lunges for the experimenter's head. Evolution takes advantage of this modularity. Different mammals use different body parts as offensive weapons, including jaws, fangs, antlers, and in the case of primates, hands. While the hindbrain circuits that drive these peripherals can be reprogrammed or swapped out as a lineage evolves, the central programs that control their emotional states are remarkably conserved. That includes the lineage leading to humans, as neurosurgeons discovered when they found a counterpart to the rage circuit in the brains of their patients. The rage circuit is a pathway that connects three major structures in the lower parts of the brain. In the midbrain, there is a collar of tissue called the periaqueductal gray. Gray, because it consists of gray matter, a tangle of neurons lacking the white sheaths that insulate output fibers. Periaqueductal, because it surrounds the aqueduct, a fluid-filled canal that runs the length of the central nervous system from the spinal cord up to large cavities in the brain. The periaqueductal gray contains circuits that control the sensory motor components of rage. They get inputs from parts of the brain that register pain, balance, hunger, blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, and hearing, particularly the shrieks of a fellow rat, all of which can make the animal irritated, frustrated, or enraged. Their outputs feed the motor programs that make the rat lunge, kick, and bite. One of the oldest discoveries in the biology of violence is the link between pain or frustration and aggression. When an animal is shocked or access to food is taken away, it will attack the nearest fellow animal or bite an inanimate object if no living target is available. The periaqueductal gray is partly under the control of the hypothalamus, a cluster of nuclei that regulate the animal's emotional, motivational, and psychological state, including hunger, thirst, and lust. The hypothalamus monitors the temperature, pressure, and chemistry of the bloodstream and sits on top of the pituitary gland, which pumps hormones into the bloodstream that regulate, among other things, the release of adrenaline from the adrenal glands and the release of testosterone and estrogen from the gonads. Two of its nuclei, the medial and ventrolateral, are parts of the rage circuit. Ventral refers to the belly side of the animal, as opposed to its dorsal or back side. The terms were grandfathered over to the human brain as it evolved its perpendicular perch atop a vertical body. So in the human brain, ventral points to our feet and dorsal to the top of our scalp. Modulating the hypothalamus is the amygdala, Latin for almond, the shape it takes in the human brain. The amygdala is a small, multi-part organ connected to brain systems for memory and motivation. It applies the emotional coloring to our thoughts and memories, particularly fear. When an animal has been trained to expect a shock after a tone, the amygdala helps to store the connections that give the tone its aura of anxiety and dread. The amygdala also lights up at the sight of a dangerous predator or of a threatening display from a member of the same species. In the case of humans, for example, the amygdala responds to an angry face. And sitting on top of the entire rage circuit is the cerebral cortex, the thin layer of gray matter on the outer surface of the cerebral hemispheres, where the computations behind perception, thinking, planning, and decision-making are carried out. Each cerebral hemisphere is divided into lobes, and the one at the front, the frontal lobe, computes decisions relevant to how to behave. One of the major patches of the frontal lobes sits on top of the eye sockets in the skull, also known as orbits, so it is called the orbitofrontal cortex, orbital cortex for short. The orbital cortex is densely connected to the amygdala and other emotional circuits, and it helps integrate emotions and memories into decisions about what to do next. When the animal modulates its readiness to attack in response to the circumstances, including its emotional state and any lessons it has learned in the past, it is this part of the brain, behind the eyeballs, that is responsible. By the way, though I have described the control of rage as a top-down chain of command, orbital cortex to amygdala to hypothalamus to periaqueductal gray to motor programs, the connections are all two-way. There is considerable feedback and crosstalk among these components and with other parts of the brain. As I mentioned, predation and rage play out very differently in the behavioral repertoire of a carnivorous mammal and are triggered by electrical stimulation of different parts of the brain. Predation involves a circuit that is part of what Panksepp calls the seeking system. A major part of the seeking system runs from a part of the midbrain via a bundle of fibers in the middle of the brain, the medial forebrain bundle, to the lateral hypothalamus, and from there up to the ventral striatum, a major part of the so-called reptilian brain. The striatum is composed of many parallel tracts, giving it a striated appearance, and it is buried deep in the cerebral hemispheres and densely connected to the frontal lobes. The seeking system was discovered when the psychologists James Olds and Peter Milner implanted an electrode into the middle of a rat brain, hooked it up to a lever in a Skinner box, and found that the rat would press the lever to stimulate its own brain until it dropped of exhaustion. Originally, they thought they had found the pleasure center in the brain, But neuroscientists today believe that the system underlies wanting or craving rather than actual pleasure. The major realization of adulthood that you should be careful about what you want, because when you get it, you may not enjoy it, has a basis in the anatomy of the brain. The seeking system is held together not just by wiring, but by chemistry. Its neurons signal to each other with a neurotransmitter called dopamine. Drugs that make dopamine more plentiful, like cocaine and amphetamines, jazz the animal up, while drugs that decrease it, like antipsychotic medications, leave the animal apathetic. The ventral striatum also contains circuits that respond to a different family of transmitters, the endorphins or endogenous opiates. These circuits are more closely related to enjoying a reward once it arrives than to craving it in anticipation. The seeking system identifies goals for the animal to pursue, like access to a lever that it may press to receive food. In more natural settings, the seeking system motivates a carnivorous animal to hunt. The animal stalks its quarry in what we can imagine is a state of pleasant anticipation. If successful, it dispatches the prey in a quiet bite that is completely unlike the snarling attack of rage. Animals can attack both in offense and in defense. The simplest trigger of an offensive attack is sudden pain or frustration, the latter delivered as a signal from the seeking system. The reflex may be seen in some of the primitive responses of a human being. Babies react with rage when their arms are suddenly pinned at their sides, and adults may lash out by swearing or breaking things when they hit their thumb with a hammer, or are surprised by not getting what they expect, as in the technique of computer repair called percussive maintenance. Defensive attacks, which in the rat consist of lunging at the head of an adversary rather than kicking and biting its flank, are triggered by yet another brain system, the one that underlies fear. The fear system, like the rage system, consists of a circuit that runs from the periaqueductal gray through the hypothalamus to the amygdala. The fear and rage circuits are distinct, connecting different nuclei in each of these organs, but their physical proximity reflects the ease with which they interact. Mild fear can trigger freezing or flight, but extreme fear, combined with other stimuli, can trigger an enraged defensive attack. Forward panic or rampage in humans may involve a similar standoff from the fear system to the rage system. Panksepp identifies a fourth motivational system in the mammalian brain that can trigger violence. He calls it the intermale aggression or dominance system. Like fear and rage, it runs from the periaqueductal gray through the hypothalamus to the amygdala, connecting yet another trio of nuclei along the way. Each of these nuclei has receptors for testosterone. As Panksepp notes, in virtually all mammals, male sexuality requires an assertive attitude, so that male sexuality and aggressiveness normally go together. Indeed, these tendencies are intertwined throughout the neuroaxis, and to the best of our limited knowledge, the circuitry for this type of aggression is located near and probably interacts strongly with both rage and seeking circuits. To psychologize the anatomy, the seeking system leads a male to willingly, even eagerly, seek out an aggressive challenge with another male. But when the battle is joined and one of them is in danger of defeat or death, focused fighting may give way to blind rage. Panksepp notes that the two kinds of aggression, though they interact with each other, are neurobiologically distinct. When certain parts of the medial hypothalamus or striatum are damaged, the animal is more likely to attack a prey animal or an unwitting experimenter, but less likely to attack another male. And as we shall see, giving an animal or a man testosterone does not make him testy across the board. On the contrary, it makes him feel great while putting a chip on his shoulder when he is faced with a rival male. One look at a human brain and you know you are dealing with a very unusual mammal. All the parts of the rat brain have been carried over to the human brain, including the organs that house the circuits for rage, fear, and dominance, the amygdala, the hypothalamus, and the periaqueductal gray, which is found inside the midbrain, lining the cerebrospinal canal running through it. The dopamine-fueled striatum, whose ventral portion helps set goals for the whole brain to seek, is also prominent. But while these structures take up a large proportion of the rat brain, in the human brain they are enveloped by a bloated cerebrum. The outsized cerebral cortex has been wrinkled like a wad of newspaper to get it to fit inside the skull. A large part of the cerebrum is taken up by the frontal lobes, which in this view of the brain extend about three-quarters of the way back. The neuroanatomy suggests that in Homo sapiens, primitive impulses of rage, fear,